partner is Dorothy Spoon. And tonight we're going to reminisce some experiences in the early 1930s in the Lost Cascades. And this is going to be very informal chit-chat, so we hope that you'll feel free to interrupt and ask questions if you wish. At that time, I was Dorothy Jackson, and this Dorothy was Dorothy Isaacs. But to the Forest Service, we were known as the two Dorothys. We have entitled this 50 Years Ago in the North Cascades. Actually, in 1933, we hadn't yet met. That was to come in 1934. But in 1933, I did a 93-mile solo backpack around Mount Rainier on the Wonderland Trail. And that just whetted my appetite to get into more remote places and really explore the wilderness. But I knew that I would not be able to do that alone. You see, in Mount Rainier National Park, you do have Park Service stations around the mountain, and I didn't set out to do that trip alone. I had a friend on the other side of the mountain who had been born at the mountain and I was planning to meet her, and then we were going to do the remainder of the trip. And I had the Park Service permission to hike alone from sunrise to paradise, which I incidentally did in one day. And when I got around to paradise, my friend was not able to go with me because an uncle or a close relative had passed away. The funeral was about to be held. No way could she take off on such a trip. And she wanted me to wait a few days, you know, until reasonably she could get away from the family. And I couldn't do it because I was teaching school, and this was the end of August, and I just had a few days left that last week of August, and then I had to be back at school. So I figured I would have to give up the trip right there. And so I asked the park ranger if there was any bus service around, how I'd go out to get back to where I left some of my gear in Sunrise, because I had been in Sunrise hiking for a couple of weeks before that out of there. And he said, well, or I said, or should I just hike back the way I came? And he said, well, why don't you go on around the mountain? And I said, I didn't think you'd let me do it alone. And he said, well, you came around the east side alone, didn't you? And that's the least patrolled side. He said, of course, you'd have to follow a set itinerary, and you'd have to phone in every night from a park ranger station. So we sat down and worked out the agenda, and I took 5 days then to do the remainder of the mountain. But you can see why then. I was really anxious to get going and got Forest Service maps and really looked over a lot of things. And then I thought, all right, where do I get a hiking partner that will go with me, that's willing to, you know, really take off into the wild? And that's where Dorothy came in.
Well, that was the next year, 1934. And I kind of look back at that 50 years later and kind of wonder, because we had never met. And one weekend in July, climbing Mount Baker was the first time we met, and I heard Dorothy talk about Mount Rainier, and that sounded good. I was a greenhorn. And she was looking for a hiking partner, so I said, here I am. Everyone who was used to hiking, backpacking, said, you can't go with just two of you, there's got to be three. And there was not a third person, and we weren't sure we wanted we weren't sure how we would get along, much less how we'd get along with the third person. And 3 weeks later, we started out together on a 3-week backpack trip, having just met that one weekend and then some planning that we did between.
180 miles backpack trip. Well, after we had kind of outlined an itinerary together, studying over the maps, we decided that we would like to go through Hannigan Pass and down the Chilliwack and then parallel the Canadian boundary through Whatcom Pass and down to the Skagit River and then come down the Skagit to Diablo Dam. And then we had further, that would take, we figured the
2 weeks.
That would have taken about, we figured 1 week, I think, for that. Then we were going up Ruby Creek and over the Granite, over Rainy Pass, where the highway now goes, didn't then come down the Steek and come down to Bridge Creek to Stehekin, and that would be our second week. And then our third week was to come over to Lucerne and up through this, the Railroad Creek Valley, and over Cloudy Pass and Seattle Pass and on Miner's Ridge and then down the Seattle and eventually get back to Bellingham, where we were both sort of headquartered at that time. That would be our last week. So we had this all figured out, and we went to the Mount Baker National Forest supervisor and talked it over with him. And he thought it was fine except for the first week. And he said we should not go through the Whatcom Pass area because this was real wilderness. It had been declared a primitive area. The trail had not been maintained through there for several years. There had been a blowdown and a silver thaw in there, and the trees were stacked, and there was no telephone line, no guard service, and the more he talked, the more he sold us on that week.
A few trees down, that's a few trees down.
Yeah. In those days, there were not very many people hiking. In fact, about the only people we met, I think the only people we met on that whole trip were Forest Service people, except the daughter of the guard up on the Granite, and she had come up from California
to visit her dad.
To visit her father, who was the guard up there. So they didn't have any set policy, you know. They hadn't been confronted with this before. Nowadays, they simply would have said, "No, you're not going." Period. But we kept telling him, yes, we were going. And so he made out our fire permits for us. And our fire permits sort of read like a book for a 3-week trip. And he said he would give us, and I think it was 8 days, to get through the area which paralleled the Canadian boundary. And if we hadn't made it in that time, he was sending in a crew with shotguns. And I haven't figured out yet what they were for.
Pretty good idea.
He said also that when we got through to the Skagit, the boundary guard station, which is just at that time, it was just about 8 or 9 miles south of the Canadian boundary. And incidentally, all that area now is at the bottom of Ross Lake. But then it was really the Skagit River. He said when we got through there, there would be a telephone in the shelter there, and we were to phone down to Reflector Bar, which was on Diablo, at Diablo Dam. And we were asked to ask them to put us through directly to his office in Bellingham, because he wanted to talk to us directly himself. And so we started out very happy that we were going on this And you want to take it from there for a while?
To the logs?
To the logs, okay,
to
all
the
right.
Logs. It was fine. Hard work on the shoulders and on the back. And we got, I guess it was the second day, we got over Whatcom Pass. And we found out what he meant by blowdown. The trees were stacked like this. It was not just a tree here and there, but they were really down. And one day, I think we made maybe 6 miles, 4 miles.
There were 2 days.
And about 10 hours of work climbing up and over and under these trees.
I wore out the seat of my pants.
actually covered up the trail. We'd get up and walk on the logs. In fact, we started naming the streets, like going through Seattle. We'd go down Pike and over to Third, name the logs that we were traveling. And we could find signs of trail down there so that we knew we were okay. Then we began picking up blazes on the trees. But the puzzling thing was why they had put the blazes so high. You know, they had cut the bark and we could see these. So we forgot about the trail and started watching for blazes. And they were way up over our head. But they certainly helped. It made it a lot easier to get through. And it was later down at Reflector Bar that we met the guard who had put them in. He had a trap line up in there, and he had blazed it during the winter when the ground was covered with several feet of snow. And yet he had put it in close enough along the creek there that we could follow it in the summertime and come through okay. He was on the trail that close. And let's see, was it 3 days getting through that?
Yeah, well, one of the things that I remember was when, you know, we'd get tired of these trees and all these logs, and we were so far above the ground. I remember it got hot in there to boot, and there was some old thunder and lightning off in the east, and we realized the precarious situation we were in if there was a lightning strike in that timber. And I remember one afternoon when it was so hot of Dorothy sitting up on top of these logs. And I had gotten to a lower level somewhere, and she was weeping. And I felt so guilty. I thought, oh, I drug her out here in this mess. And how will she ever be able to tolerate me for the next 2.5 weeks? And then we'd get out of a timbered area and we'd come to one of these slide areas, you know. And the vine maple would just be laying flat. But we'd pick up little pieces of the trail. And I remember a couple of places there where the trail just disappeared under the vine maple. So we got down and snaked our way through on the trail and pushed the packs through. Well, it was easier than trying to. Have you ever tried to climb over top of vine maple?
Yeah.
Not to mention Devil's Club.
Yeah, that was in another little area, and then whoever went first, the second one, of course, snaked through too. So then we decide, well, maybe the trees weren't quite so bad, and then the next thing we get into on the kind of the break between the trees. And the slide area would be Devil's Club patches. And we got into some that were actually over our head. But we could find the trail. The trail did go through there. Mm-hmm. And since we were acquainted with Devil's Club, having hiked a lot in the Pacific Northwest, we knew not to touch them. They're kind of a club-like thing. Many of you know what they're like, but they have little hooks. Fine hooks, even on the leaves, a bit like a fish hook, and they will tend to fester if you get them in your fingers. But you'll want to grab onto those stems sometimes, and that's something you should not do. They're rather attractive. They have nice red berries on them. Rather attractive. Then we get back into the trees again, and so we alternated with this back and forth.
After one day of really hard hiking, it was about the third one, I think, when we were really getting tired and we'd spent long hours, we decided to cook our supper and then go on and hike until dark to cut the next day. We figured we'd really have to push it to get out. And while we were either having our supper or packing up our packs, putting things back, I don't remember which, we began to hear a funny sound. And we weren't sure what we were hallucinating, because it sounded like an axe, somebody chopping. And, maybe half a mile, less than half a mile down the trail, we came to the camp of a trail crew, two men who had been sent in to clear trail, coming from the other way. And this one man had the same idea we had. I think he'd gone out after his supper, and he was going to clear out some of those logs to cut their day's work the next day, because they'd been working so hard. And he was so happy to see two gals come through there. He was delighted, because he knew they had it made. If we could do it, there wouldn't be any logs. It was going to be a sack. This was going to make their work so much easier. And he really said, you know, that it was going to be easy, because they had really worked so hard. Wait till you see the logs we've cut out. Just see what we've done, you know. We sure cut a lot of them.
And we said, we have news for you.
They had cut a lot, but yes, nothing to what they still had ahead of them.
Right.
They really hadn't seen the heavy blowdown.
I had one very good lesson on that trip. Actually, it was the night before, the day before we met these fellows on the trail crew. And that lesson has stayed with me all of my life, and affected the way I act in the woods too. We had stopped at the Stillwell cabin, and the Forest Service had told us about this cabin. And we were actually on the ground there. The trees hadn't blown down in that particular little patch. And we opened the cabin door, and we closed it again quickly and knew that we would be camping outside. The trapper who had been through there in December apparently had set one of these mouse traps, you know, the 5-gallon can type, partially filled with water, with a prune suspended and a little gang plank that goes up to the, but the prune is on an empty spool, and the gangplank goes up so that if the mouse reaches out for the prune, it turns, and then he goes plunk in the water. Well, this had been working for 6 months. And, Trapper Lucille should have heard about that. And so we spread our bed outside, and there was a circle of stones out there for a campfire, and we scraped away. We thought we had done a pretty good job of that, scraping away around the rocks. And after we had cooked our dinner that evening, or supper, we stretched out our sleeping bags close to our campfire and just let it burn out. The next morning, we decided not to start a fire, that we would just eat a cold breakfast and get on our way, because we knew we had a hard day ahead of us. And as I was rolling up my sleeping bag, I discovered that the ground was warm underneath me. And we knew what had happened then, that with this area being inactive, the trail being closed, duff had collected over those years. And the trapper who had been there 6 months before, of course, the snow was on the ground at that time, and he was probably using the cabin. And if a fire ever got started then, we realized that fire from our... We had not dug the dirt out deep enough, you see. You really got to go down to mineral soil. You can't just paw away at it. And we practically plowed up that place before we left, because we just couldn't afford having a fire getting started there. We carried bucket after bucket after bucket of water and drowned the whole area around there to make sure that there wasn't a remaining root down in there that was burning. But that was a real good lesson to have happen at the beginning of our adventures together. Excuse my voice here. then we, to carry on from where Dorothy left off with these fellows, when we hiked on down then the remaining 6 miles to the Skagit River, and these fellows had been working, they told us they had been working for 2 weeks, and they had only gotten the log sawed out in about six miles, I guess it was. But that was really a cinch that day. We went along and we patted the ends of these logs that they sawed out, you know, and said, we didn't have to climb over you. And then we got down to the Skagit River and were confronted with a log jam. And they had told us we'd be crossing on a log jam. And it wasn't a stacked up log jam.
That's what I thought a log jam was. Yeah. I thought we had logs all piled up, maybe like a beaver dam that you could climb up over and get to the other
These
side.
These logs were all sitting on the water like this. And we just went across it. We look back on some of the things we used to do. And I wonder.
They really weren't like this. They were like this. Crossing the Skagit River on a log.
Yeah. But there were a lot of them there together, you know. You couldn't make it from one to the other.
Some weren't, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we made it.
We had to. There wasn't any doubt about it.
We had to. He was going to send in shotguns if we didn't. Well, at any rate, the phone was on the other side. We got to the cabin. And these were the old crank phones, you know. You had so many rings to get in there. There'd be a little legend on the wall so you'd know whether to call Desolation Peak or Devil's Peak or the such and such ranger station. Anyway, we cranked the reflector bar, and Pagter himself was there. And so right away he wanted to know how things were, and I said, well, if you think those two fellows that you sent in there to brush out are going to make it on through to Whatcom Pass, you better start preparing their Thanksgiving dinner, or at least thinking what the menu is, because they've got the real job ahead of them. And I told him how far they were in. And they did then, later, we went back through there in 1937. We had to go back and see what they did, because on other shorter trips that we've taken into the area, the Forest Service, I guess they talked about that for years, brushing out that trail. And it did take them into October, and that was the first part of August that we went through there. So you can guess how bad it was, and he did send in reinforcements for them. But they said that they had plenty of snow in there before they actually got it all done and got out.
Well, I think the next highlight would be at Lake Chelan. We came into Stehekin from the north to Stehekin and took the old lady, down to Lucerne, where we did stay overnight down at Lucerne. And there we learned that there was a road up into the mountains, and that if we would wait until about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, there'd be a truck come down from the mine area and we could ride back up. And that would save us 12 miles of hiking. But that was 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And we knew that by 1 o'clock in the afternoon we could be here.
Yeah, so we told them that. We said, 1 o'clock in the afternoon, we would like to get going hiking in the morning. And then some of them agreed with us, and others were very insistent that it was very foolish for us to walk
when there
would be a truck coming down. So then they got into arguments among themselves, and we just slipped out with our gear and took off to the woods and rolled on our sleeping bags and went to bed and got up early the next morning before anybody had stirred in the resort. Incidentally, the Lucerne Resort was quite a thriving place in the early 30s. There were a lot of people there. And we started on up. I remember I had some difficulty the first 2 or 3 miles coming up that road, because You know, having been out in the woods for a couple of weeks by then, when we got to a place that served wild blackberry pie, and stuff like that, you know.
Chicken dinner, I think.
I think it was a chicken dinner, and I think we'd sort of gorged ourselves. And I felt it the next morning. But we got up to the mine around, I think it was probably around 10:30 or 11 in the morning. And the road, incidentally, was brand new at that time. That's why the fellows down at Lucerne were so excited about it. I don't know how long they'd been working on it, getting it all the way through, but it had just been completed that summer. And it crossed over, crossed Railroad Creek, at right about 10 mile, I think. The first time I came up here after the church had taken over was in 1968, and first thing I had to do was to go up to the mine and backtrack the signs of that old road down, and it sort of disappeared into the tailings. And I have never tried to pick it up on this side. I should do that sometimes. I'm afraid there have been so many other little logging roads and so forth in there, I'm not sure if I could identify the original. But it crossed over kind of in the flat there, where it came up parallel with the river, and then it zigzagged up on the other side. And then the road did continue on past the mine portal, and the portal that was there in 1934 is the portal as we know it, the main portal. And there was a concrete building. The foundation of it is still there. I thought it was concrete. Maybe it was wood, but it seemed at that time to me that parts of it were concrete at any rate. And that seemed to be their headquarters, a very pleasant fellow who was in charge. And so we visited with him, and he told us what they were doing. And then we thought we would hike on down. We knew that there was campgrounds down on the river, because we had a fire permit for there and a fire permit for Heart Lake, and then the next one was Lyman Lake. And we were going to go down and fix the lunch, and he said, well, wouldn't you like to eat inside the mine with the miners? And so, sure we would. So he put us in a little mine car, and there was a little track that went in, and there was only about 1,000 feet of bore in there. And I mean, we got to the end of the mine in about 1,000 feet, and I thought, we could have walked this, you know. There was a room down in there that's not very large, and about 4 or 5 miners in it. And, he gave us each a sack lunch and to take with us. Anyway, we sat in there and visited with the miners and ate our sack lunch, and then they put us back in the mine car and brought us back out of the mine. And this particular incident ruined one of Ernie Zorb's stories one time, because I don't know how many of you would know Ernie Zorb, but he has been on teaching staff up here and used to lead mine hikes a lot. And one time going on a mine hike, he was just about to tell them that no woman had ever entered that mine. And, but before he got it said, I had turned to him and I said, because we were walking by the portal, and I said, Ernie, do you know there's a room about 1,000 feet in, a little room down there on the left-hand side? And he looked at me, and I said, well, I had lunch in there one time. He said, you did? And he said, the miner said, he said, you just ruined my next story. Because the miner said no woman was ever allowed to set foot in that mine. Because if they did, it was bad luck, and there might be a mine accident. But at any rate, we know that we've been in there, nothing happened.
Well, they talk about the history here. They talk about 1938 being the start of the mine. 37 or 38, how sound. But we were there in 34, but they were not mining as, so this is why they say it. They were doing test holing and doing enough in order to hold the claim. which they have, in order to hold a claim, you have to work it. And so this is all they were doing, was simply, you know, they were simply holding the claim and testing it out to see what they had. But they had not really started heavy mining.
I don't know if they had decided by that time that it was really, you know, worth going ahead, because I understand that the real production started in about 1937. And I don't know whether the village was on paper then or not. It certainly didn't exist. This village was just woods over here, because they were apparently living up at Honeymoon Heights. We didn't hike up to Honeymoon Heights to find out, but I presume from what I have seen and heard that that's where they were living at that time.
They had this one big building where they had diesel engine. They had diesel equipment. And the fellow that we talked to was the diesel engineer. So that I do, that's why I do remember that, that there was a diesel plant.
This reminds me, Dorothy and I turned out to be pretty good hiking partners. We sort of complemented each other. I was very spatially oriented, map oriented. Remembered the names of all the creeks and peaks and places we were. Dorothy is people oriented. And she remembers every person we've met. But sometimes I have to tell her where we met them. So I had forgotten he was a diesel engineer, but you see the people person here, she remembered that.
I didn't know that much about diesel engines in those days, so I was pretty surprised, pretty impressed, I guess.
Right.
With it being up here in the mountains.
Well, we finally did take off then. We decided we would go down and look over the campgrounds, but it was still early in the day after we'd had lunch there. And, we saw the truck take off from up here to go down. And we thought, well, we'd go on up to Heart Lake and camp for the night. And the trail went down to Heart Lake, but the trail to Lyman did not go down to Heart Lake. The trail to Lyman, you know where you get to the place above the falls, where you break over there? It continued right on around, crossed all that rock slide, right on around the mountain. And so we stood there and thought, shall we go down to the lake? And the flies were bothering us. It was August, remember. And we thought, why don't we go down over all those rocks and sit in the flies? We've got this elevation, let's just keep on going up and find a place to stop. And so we did. We continued on up to Lyman Lake that night and camped at Lyman Lake. So that made a nice hike that I don't think I could do today from Lucerne to Lyman Lake. But we were up there by about 5:30 or 6 o'clock. And there was a very nice cabin up there then. It was the Lake Chelan, the Chelan Electric Company. In fact, it was the best cabin we ever ran into at that time. It was a fairly new and well-built.
And at that time, it was not locked. Nowadays, if there was one there, they'd have to keep it locked and barred. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't.
They take them out nowadays and just don't have them in there. So we hung around there for a few days, or a couple of days, I guess it was. And then continued on. And when we finally did come down the Suaddle to, it would be Sulphur Creek, where you hit the end of the road. And we were doing that last stretch. And incidentally, this is several days later from the time we were at Cloudy Pass. It got dark on us on the trail, and we were trying to come in to Sulphur Creek at night. Finally, we gave up and found a level place and rolled out our sleeping bags, crawled into them. Next morning, we discovered we were only about 100 yards from the camp. We'd gotten that far. So then we hiked on down to Buck Creek, and one of the Forest Service employees from Bellingham happened to be in there, and he was heading back to Bellingham that day, and we got a ride back to Bellingham. And we really could have stayed out. We sort of sat on the curb in Bellingham and moaned the fact that we had come out of the woods a little bit too early. We still had two more days.
Could have used 2 more days food.
Yes. That pretty well covers the highlights of that particular trip, which was a 180-mile backpack trip. Dorothy and I did several other longer trips. That was our shortest long backpack. I think our very longest one was 276 miles. And we did also a lot of short weekend things and day things, or we would go to an area. At that time, Stevens Pass was a lot more primitive than it is now, and there was a good campgrounds up there, and I remember we spent 1 week just hiking out and climbing from Stevens Pass, and we do that sometimes. We also went back up into the Upper Skagit area several times, and which I'm going to tell that story. She told me I couldn't do it. Well, one time, I think it was the second time.
Oh, that one.
1937, we came through and enjoyed the trail. It was all cleared out beautifully. Got down to the Boundary Guard Station and decided to stay there a few days and clean up and so on. And anyway, we went in and decided we'd start the stove in the cabin there and cook us a dinner. And so we did. And after a little bit, we began to smell chocolate. But it smelled like chocolate might be burning, you know. We couldn't figure this out. And we opened the oven. And the lookout on Desolation Peak is located right above the Boundary Guard Station. And the mail had been brought up for the lookout, and the mail was lying there. And maybe we should have realized that there might be something. They didn't want the mice to invade. And his girlfriend had sent in a box of homemade fudge. And they the fellow who brought it in had the packer who had brought in the mail and the package had put this in the oven to keep the mice out of it, and we had absolutely ruined it. So you know what we had to do when we got out of there. We didn't make him a box of fudge, but we did send him a box of chocolates. We used to take in, if we knew that we were going to climb lookouts, which we did do along the way, we'd often climb them, we would take their mail into them as we stopped at the ranger station on the way in. And we would carry extra copies of Reader's Digest and drop them off so they'd have some fresh reading material, because some of those fellows, you know, are in there all summer, and some of those lookouts are rather remote. It's a little different now, I think. They do a lot of that work by plane. They use radios. I think they have missed some things. That old wind-up telephone was a whale of a lot of fun. We would come into an area and take the phone quietly off the hook and listen, and particularly if it was after hours, you know, after dinner hours in the evening, and we'd be real quiet. And one of the things that was quite common in the forest for entertainment, so they didn't have radios up there, you see. They were really out there without them. But they would could hook up, you know, all, or maybe six different lookouts could all get on the same party line, wind-up line. And they would put on their own programs. You know, somebody would sing, somebody had a guitar, somebody would recite poetry. And I remember one time, one place, and I think this was at Benchmark, that where they could hook in across into the neighboring, it would be between the Mount Baker and the Chelan Forest. And there was just one lookout that was over in the Chelan, and the rest of these fellows were all in the Mount Baker. And the fellow in the Chelan claimed that he was not talented, and he just, you know, couldn't contribute to the program. So they would threaten to cut him off, because they had some way that they could. They could throw a switch, and he was out of it. He had to come up with something. Well, anyway, we would sort of tune in on these programs that were going on, and after there would be a little lull, then we would either start to sing or say something, and this would really set them going, because they'd say, "Hey, who's got a woman over there?" They would really check around, you know. Is it you? And that after they had suffered with this for a while, everybody denying that they had anyone there, why, we would finally come on the line and tell them who we were, and so, but that was fun. Do you have any questions?
What kind of food did you take with you, Dorothy?
Dehydrated. It's nice to know they're back to it. No, the dehydrated food that we had was not nearly as good as what you have today. We didn't particularly like the powdered milk. You had to stir it so much, and the powdered eggs, yuck. But that's what we did take, and we had even dehydrated vegetables, dehydrated tomatoes and other vegetables. We also carried oatmeal and some rice too, some things that took a little longer to cook. We started out with a pound of bacon. We'd pick up a pound of bacon in each place, and that would provide the fat for any frying that we did. Did a little fishing, particularly on the Skagit River. All I had along for a line, just a string, you know, line. I didn't have a pole. And a bit of whatever they used for filament in 34. And I used the police whistle. So I had a little police whistle along. We took that so we could signal to each other if we needed to, or somebody else. I used that as a weight to weight the hook down. And we caught fish. But the problem that we had in the Skagit, in some of the creeks leading into the Skagit, was the fish were so, they were too big for us. I mean, I had to pull my hook out, because they were so big that if we caught one, I mean, that would have been wasting the meat. We couldn't possibly eat all that, so we just pull our line out and wait till something small came in. And that is a true story, isn't it?
We ate fish.
We ate fish.
I think you would have lost the line.
What about the wild
animals? Oh, good.
Oh, I remember up at the Snoqualmie Lake one time when I woke up in the middle of the night with feeling something down inside my sleeping bag. And this was about between 2 and 3 in the morning, and I unzipped and crawled out. It didn't settle down, and so I crawled out and I turned it in my bag inside out, and I was standing there shaking it like this, and Dorothy woke up and, "What on earth are you doing?" 3 in the morning, it was a little mouse that had gotten down in my sleeping bag. Yeah, about the wild animals. We always considered ourselves quite fortunate if we saw a bear, because the bears were really wild bears in those days, and they There were not that many people out in the woods, and so if they got our scent, they would disappear. And if they saw us, of course, they would disappear. And we were accustomed to bears always going away from us. There are two times when, once when Dorothy and I were together, and once when I was alone, when the bear didn't do that. Down the trail, I saw the bear coming up the trail towards me, and I just kept going because I expected him to turn around and run. I just kept coming right toward me. And I remembered rather quickly that when you meet a bear, you go down the hill, not up, because bears can go faster and easier uphill than they. Their front legs are shorter, and they don't like to go down, you see. So I simply got off the trail about 20 feet down and sat down on a log and faced the bear and watched him go poking by, and he didn't give me the time of day. And then I got back on the trail and went on my way. But the time that Dorothy and I met a mother bear came around the bend, and I was in the lead, and again I just went on because I figured she'd turn tail and run. But she didn't. She kept coming, and just then a little cub came around her and another little cub, and I started going this way to Dorothy. And we stood perfectly still. Well, we started kind of walking slowly backwards, but we faced the bear. And the cubs didn't like the looks of us. They turned and took off, and then the mother turned and took off. And we stood perfectly still until they were well into the brush and completely out of sight. And then we continued on our way. And I had walked for about 5 minutes, and all of a sudden Dorothy hit me on my back of my pack, and she said, "Get going, get going." And I thought, if that bear had changed his mind, you know. And anyway, I started to run as much as you can run on a trail with 37 pounds on your back. And when I finally was just completely out of breath, and it hadn't caught up with us yet, and I didn't know what we were running for, and I stopped dead, and I turned around and I said, "What are we running for?" And Dorothy was swatting yellow jackets.
That's the trouble of following on trail. We get the yellow jackets.
And I imagine the bears might have stirred them up some, too. That might have been one thing. We did see bears. I remember one time there was a little cub running up the trail ahead of us. And the only thing I could think, I carried a camera in those days, was getting its picture, you know, and I started going. Dorothy said, "You don't know where the mother is. Stop." Which was right. Which she
we
was.
Never did see the mother, though.
No, we never did see the mother. The bear, a little cub, finally turned around and saw us, and then it took off into the brush someplace. We saw lots of deer. Oh, when we were in Natchez Pass, not the Natchez Pass highway that you know, but the real Natchez Pass. We had. Followed the old wagon track up from the east side, the original crossing of the Cascades, where they had hacked out trees, you know, and we found the evidence of these trees cut off just enough so that a wagon going through would clear them, and the evidence of the tracks. And we had hiked up that and had camped in the meadow. And the next morning we were awakened by the most horrible, awful noise. It startled both of us, and I couldn't think. It wasn't a bear, it wasn't a coyote, it wasn't a cougar. What else was there in the mountains that could make such an awful noise? Anyway, we scrambled out of our sleeping bags pretty fast to see what it was. Donkeys. Oh. And I didn't realize they could make such an awful noise. But that was, we never had any problem with animals. We were never concerned about them. We considered We were fortunate when we saw animals.
I think now, though, about bears. I live over near the Olympic Peninsula, Olympic Park. And when I hear my friends talk about backpacking up in the Olympics, nowadays, you always hang your pack, and you hang it high with a rope. And you would not dare camp with your pack on the ground. In fact, if you leave it on the ground and get a little ways from it, there'll be a bear there within an hour's time. And back then, our system at night with our pack was to put it at our head of our sleeping bag and put the flap up over it to keep the mice and the chipmunks out. We never thought about the bears coming around to get into the food. They never did, and we never even considered that as a possibility. But you wouldn't dare do that nowadays.
There's one story we thought you might be interested in hearing, and this was on our 1937 trip, coming again through Whatcom Pass in that area. We came down from the Boundary Guard Station down to Lightning Creek and decided to head up that through that area and hit the Cascade Crest Trail that wasn't built yet, and come down it. And we went up Lightning Creek and Three Fools Creek and into Elbow Basin. And we had heard, the Forest Service had been mentioning that there was a party that they referred to as the Millionaire Party that would be coming through from the opposite direction. We would meet them somewhere along the line. And so we kind of speculated on this. This was supposed to be a doctor from New York City who had camped and had been on some trips through the North Cascades, but he had always come with men. And he wanted to give his wife and his two daughters this experience. And so he had his family with him this time, and we were given a rough idea of their itinerary, and we were expecting to meet them up in Elbow Basin, and had hoped that we knew there was a sheep camp up in Elbow Basin, and we had hoped that our timing would be such that they would be in the sheep camp and we'd get there at the same time, and we'd sit around the campfire and hear their stories, you know, of how they were doing it. Well, it so happened that where we met them was on the driest, dustiest stretch between the Three Fools Camp and Elbow Basin. And we were doing switchback after switchback and deep dust, and what do we see coming but a string of horses. And the lady was in the lead, and when she met us, we stepped down, and she reined in and greeted us, and she said, "Where is your party?" And we said, "Right here." And she said, "Well, where is your gear?" And we said, "Right here." And she said, "You mean just the two of you?" "Yes." "No horses?" "No." "Nobody else?" "No." She got off her horse. And then she stopped the whole party. And the party consisted of 11 riding horses and 25 pack horses. And here we were in the middle of this dusty old trail. Well, the next person to come forward was the district ranger, because the riding horses, let's see, what all did they have? There were the four of them, and they had a guide,
and a horse wrangler,
and a horse wrangler, and a cook, and a doctor, and a nurse, and I think there were two horse wranglers.
For that many.
Oh, and then the district ranger from each district met them at the boundary and conducted them through to the next, and then the next picked up. And anyway, it made 11 people, and that was why there was 11 horses. And we knew they had quite a pack string, because when we had stopped at Lightning Creek, before we ever left the Skagit, a packer had come up the day that we left, and he had 150, was it, loaves of bread? Something like that.
At any rate,
and he was waiting there. They were supposed to come down to Lightning Creek, he thought. And he was waiting there. We heard afterwards that he finally got tired of waiting and he hung the bread up and took off. And they never did go to Lightning Creek. They went out by Hozamine instead. They changed their itinerary and left the bread there. But they had a stove along with them anyway. And so they could bake some bread, I guess, along the way. Well, at any rate, the ranger knew us, recognized us right away. And so he had everybody dismount. And he also knew where there was a spring nearby. So he had us all come over. It was about 150 feet off the trail. We never would have known it was there because it wasn't marked in any way. Because this, again, is in the primitive area. And so the whole party trekked over there, all 13 of us, and here was this nice, cool spring and some nice, big, mossy logs. We all sat down, and Dorothy and I had envisioned, and we kind of talked over, we were thinking of all the things we were going to ask them and find out about how they did it. And after this was all over, and we were on our way, winding up this the switchbacks, we realized we hadn't had a chance to ask them anything because all 11 of them were zeroed in on us and to find out how we did it and so on. But the doctor was quite perturbed because we weren't carrying oranges. He was worried about our vitamin C. Well, good night. We got those off, the blueberries and the huckleberries and all other kinds of berries that we found along the way. Didn't have any problem with vitamin C, but they did present us each with an orange, which we appreciated receiving. And then we went on up from there and got into Elbow Basin, and the sheep herder was beside himself because he had been in there for 2 or 3 months and no one had come along. Nobody. And then one day, here comes 11 people and 35 horses, and the next day, here we come. And he was really so excited about having company, and he wanted to give us about everything in the place. And we didn't want anything, you know. We were down to, and we finally wound up taking a can of tomatoes because we realized we were going to offend him if we didn't take something. And, of course, he had all kinds of canned goods and stuff that had been packed in, and we were trying to avoid canned goods. And so we took that can of tomatoes, and it really helped us the next day because, or the 2 days later, because the next day we hiked on up into the summit and got into a good snowstorm and bedded down. You know, we never heard of, what do you call it, thermodynamics or something or other? We never heard of that. Hypothermia. All right. It's a little different from thermodynamics, isn't it? Quite a bit. Anyway, when we got into a situation, we just put on all the clothes that we had with us, you know. And crawled into our sleeping bags and we're snug.
How old were you at that time?
In our early 20s.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
I was teaching, and I think you were still in college.
Where did you go on that 270-mile trip?
Well, that was the one that where we started from down south of Mount Rainier and came north and came up the Crest Trail north. And with a few side trips. And that was one we did after I was married. I don't think you were married then. And my husband joined us on part of it. And which also reminds us, we had the highest regard for the Forest Service. We thought they were really great. You know, their slogan, the greatest good for the greatest number in the long run. And we thought they really lived up to that very well and were most helpful. We encountered one guard one time who was brand spanking new and was sure to do everything just right. And it happened to be in this area. That is, it was coming down the second time that we came down to Stehekin. And, we did come down to Stehekin that time. We went up the Agnes. But at any rate, we had written the usual letter. You see, we would make up our food supply for the whole trip whenever we started on a trip. And we would figure it out in weeks. And we'd take about an 8-day supply on our backs. And we never carried more than 37 pounds, incidentally, total. And my sleeping bag weighed 11 pounds.
Oh.
And then we would mail the others into a ranger station that we would hit at the end of a week. And we would send a letter along saying, we expect to be to arrive there. This is our itinerary. And we expect to be there approximately such and such a date. And we never had any problem with that word approximately until we got to High Bridge. And we had a food supply, and I'd expected to get some mail too, because this would always be the time when we would send out letters when we hit a guard station or a ranger station. Well, at any rate, this particular guard, he really landed on us with both. We were one day late. We said approximately such and such, and we arrived the next day. And he had sent our mail back. And one letter was from my husband telling me when he was leaving to hike in to meet us on the crest. And we knew that he was hoping to do this on his, because his vacation time wasn't as extensive as mine, being a teacher at that time. And I didn't know that the letter had come and had been mailed back. I really didn't find that out until I got out. You know, there was no letter from him, and so I thought, well, maybe he wasn't going to be able to make it. Anyway, I wrote him a letter and sent it out. But when he got my letter, you know, it kind of didn't make sense to answer his. In the meantime, his letter had come back, and you can imagine the concern that he had with the two of us out there. And then his letter is returned to him, so he had anxiety until suddenly my letter comes along, and then my letter doesn't answer any of his questions at all. And so he really didn't know where to head in to meet us. Well, he did know our general itinerary, you know, way, you know, but he was reluctant to take it. We kept hiking on, thinking we would meet him all the time. We never did. We finally got out and called him up on the phone, and then he'd come and get us. But this guard also, in reprimanding us for not being there right on the dot, he was, I think, the same one that said we couldn't go over Phelps Pass because it was closed to horses. We didn't have any horses with us. And because that was, we went up the Agnes and then over Cloudy Pass and to Lyman Lake and then over what you now call, I think you call it Spider Pass, but it was called Phelps Pass at that time, and then down into Phelps and Trinity. And that was one spot where we thought we might run into my husband, but we didn't.
Not until we got down to a telephone.
Right. And he thought we had fallen in the river because it had rained. What was that?
Oh, the guard.
Mm-hmm.
Coming up from Diablo, we had camped at the pass at night, and it started to rain very early in the morning. Well, we never got our sleeping bags wet. That was one of the few nights that we got caught in the rain, and we scrambled out and rolled our bags up and decided to hike on over. So we got to start about 4 o'clock in the morning, 5 o'clock anyway, that morning.
and came down to Bridge Creek. And of course, when we got over the pass to this side, the sun was out. But we got into camp and our packs were wet. We were wet. And he never did believe that we hadn't fallen in the creek. He was sure that we told him it rained. Well, of course, he hadn't seen any rain, so it couldn't possibly have rained in the pass. Neither did he believe we had come from the pass that day.
We had a couple. It was
too far.
There were two couples, older couples, that were fishing up in there, and they took care of us like we were babies. They insisted on our going into their tent and taking off our clothes and putting on their clothes, and they dried us out.
I think about the only time that I can remember really being concerned was the day we were up above Lyman Glacier. They had different Forest Service guards, different people anyway, in talking, had told us there was no trail through there. They tried to discourage us from going through. Not only we couldn't take horses, but they tried to tell us we couldn't go through. And there was no trail and we'd have trouble. Well, they were so worried about it that they had us a little bit worried. And we came through over the pass and we started looking for a way down. And instead of doing the natural thing that we ordinarily would have done, which was be to cross the pass and drop on over until we picked up trail, well, there was no trail, so we didn't do that. We started, well, way down in the valley we could see trail, but it was cliff. And we must have spent an hour,
yeah,
at least,
hanging over cliffs,
working our way along the edge there, trying to find a way down. And finally we got disgusted, and we'd worked our way so far down that we went right on down across the meadow, picked up the trail at the bottom, and went on.
Just followed down the Spider Glacier there. You know, the trail just took off right off, but
No trail across the pass because of snow, but we wouldn't have had any trouble if they hadn't had us so concerned. We'd have picked it up right away.
Now, I might tell you one little sequel to that millionaire story and the spring that the ranger took us to there. 25 years later, I was serving on the Mount Baker National Forest Advisory Council, which I served on for 10 years. And each year they would take us on a field trip. And this particular year, the study was the North Cascades, because that was when they were debating whether it should be a national park or not. And so our field trip was back up into this area and into the Elbow Basin area again. And my husband got to go along on that trip. And when we got to Three Fools Camp that next morning, the rangers that were with us said, well, you have to carry canteens on this stretch because there is no water. And I said, oh, yes, there's water. No, there is no water. And I said, yes, there's a spring up there, halfway up, the switchbacks. No, there is no water. I said, I've been here 25 years ago. I drank out of that spring. No. Well, I carried a canteen because, you know, you can talk down the rangers when they're leading the show. And we had the Mount Baker National Forest supervisor with us. And so, but I kept watching all the way up as we went up that trail, and I wondered if after 25 years, if I could spot the place where this took off. And I got to an area where I thought, this, I really think it's along in this area somewhere. So I told the local ranger, I pulled him aside and I said, I really think it's in this area somewhere. He said, all right, on our way back, you and I are going to head out ahead of the group and see if we can find it, because if there's a spring here and the Forest Service has lost it, it's time we found it again. And so we did that. When we came out a couple of days later, then he and I went on ahead, and I went right to it. I got coming down some way, got in that area, and I just seemed to know where to go. And there it was, and the same mossy logs, still there after 25 years. And so, again, the whole party was flagged down and over to the spring to have a drink on the way down. And they flagged it that time. In fact, they they said they were going to put a sign up, Dorothy Bennett Spring. But I never went back to see if they did or not. I doubt if they did. You know, I think we've kept you people long enough, and it's more than an hour.
What's those two poles for?
Yeah.
Oh! Well, these are called alpenstocks. And
the sharp one.
Hold them up. What are they called?
Alpenstock. And these were originated in Switzerland, and they were the original climbing poles before you had ice axes. And someday I'm going to dig out my picture, my slides of a Mount Baker climb back in the 30s, where you'll see a line of people going up the glacier with alpenstocks. And this is what you used on glaciers and on mountain climbs where you had difficult climbing. And my alpenstock, these happen to be Dorothy's and her husband's, because I think I gave mine away. But mine saved my life one time, because on a climb of Mount Shuckson, and we were caught on the peak in a blizzard, and we were in quite a heavy fog coming down off the glacier in the snowfield. And we were going single file so that we could see, and had to keep the person in front of us in sight. And so we were all following the same track. And suddenly there was nothing under my feet, because I broke through one of those little snow crevasses, you know, where the snow was filled it in. And with the storm, with the rain and sleet and whatnot blowing there, it melted just enough so that, and there were enough people that had gone over it before me, so that when I came along, there was nothing under my feet. But when I found myself, I was like this. I had one elbow dug into the bank here, and there was nothing under my feet, but I was hanging on this, and it bridged it. And I don't know if I would have made it if I'd had an ice axe.
Is that why they're so long?
So no, it was just just the way they did them.
You didn't use a tent. You didn't sleep in a tent.
We never used a tent. We never used a ground cover. We would sometimes break boughs for if we felt we needed to, or we'd find a mossy place. Often, but
and you have weather that except for a few times.
Well, there was one summer that we were out 31 days that summer, and I think we figured 9 days when the sun came out, and so we would be, and it really wasn't bad weather, but we were in damp weather a lot of times.
But there were shelters, and we would be lucky to hit a shelter at a rainy time. I know one time it rained during the day, all day, so we laid over and stayed in the shelter that day until it stopped.
That was good letter writing time. You know, if it was raining, and we always found dry trees. I still wonder about the big tree, the dry tree on the Agnes.
With the big rock.
Yeah. Is there a camp? You just came up the Agnes, didn't you? Or down it? About 12 miles in, there was a nice, huge, dry tree. Because it was raining when we came through there, and we were just as snug under that tree. We had a fire going at the edge of it.
Against a big rock.
Mm-hmm, against a big rock. I often wondered if that camp was still there.
There are big trees.
But we've spent an hour looking for a dry spot to sleep because we knew it was going to rain. The night that it snowed that she talked about, I know that Dorothy spent at least an hour or more finding a sheltered spot to sleep that night.
Mm-hmm. That day started out a beautiful, sunny, clear, blue sky day. Just a gorgeous day up there. And then things began to close in as it got on top. And we stopped and cooked and And we dug out the trees, being on top, the trees were all blown over this way, you know. And we just found a place where they were nice and thick, blown over this way, and we just dug everything out underneath. And the stuff that we dug out, we banked on one side, so we had just one entryway into that, and just enough room for our two sleeping bags. And we had our little fire cooking our dinner, and when we had that eaten, we went to bed about 5 o'clock that night. The last I remember was seeing the snow come down out there. Slept like babies and got up the next morning to sunshine again. We had to hike in snow for a ways. Yes?
You said your sleeping bag weighed about 11 pounds?
I had a wool bag, a mummy bag. They were rather new at that time, too. And it had a little balloon silk fly attached to it. And this helped me a lot, and that I could stake it up. Dorothy didn't have that. The bag, the total bag, did weigh 11 pounds. Yes.
And the covers were, I don't know what
they were called. Very watery.
It was like canvas. It wasn't canvas, but it was that type of thing, and they were much more repellent than the bags, than your down bags nowadays. You have to have a waterproof now. But mine was a 10-pound Sears bag, wool, and it was the most comfortable sleeping bag I ever had. A down bag, you're either too hot, and the wool bag, I guess it would breathe enough so that it was never too hot and never cold. But it was heavy.
How much did your empty hats and hat boards and stuff weigh before you could even...